An ancient historian wrote of a Persian queen who fell ill. She had symptoms that sounded very much like breast cancer. That centuries-old case got cancer doctor Siddhartha Mukherjee thinking.
And let's imagine moving her through time across centuries and asking the question, well, what happens to her in 1622? What happens to her in 1722? And so forth. It turns out that her prognosis, her diagnosis, and the way that her disease with changes drastically over time.
In ancient times, people didn't even have the word cancer. Even a few centuries ago, she might have been subjected to crude surgery that could have killed her.
In 2010, she avails of surgery, chemotherapy, radiation, targeted therapy. She has psychic and psychological supports, if appropriate, and her lifespan has increased. We don't know exactly how, by how much, but on the order of 17 to 20 years.
Dr. Mukherjee traces that evolution in a new book called The Emperor of All Maladies. He calls it a biography of cancer, though it's just as much a biography of our efforts to fight it. Some breakthroughs over the years came from unexpected people in unexpected places. Consider modern chemotherapy. It is directly linked to 19th century clothing dyes, chemicals that drew the curiosity of a German scientist.
That was, of course, Paul Ehrlich. He was writing his thesis, and he took one of these dyes, and he said, well, it's a dye. It colors cotton. So what if I just took this dye and I put it on some animal tissue? And he throws the dye on animal tissues, and all of a sudden he begins to see that the dye, it only lights up certain parts, certain organelles inside the cell, not every piece of it. And he begins to wonder, is there specificity? Is it true that the dye only can attach itself to certain organelles and not to others? And this idea of specificity obsesses him. He says, well, maybe there are chemicals in the world that only attach themselves to certain bacteria, not to others, or only to certain cells and not to others. And you can see where this is going. This is the invention, essentially, of chemotherapy, the idea that you can take a chemical and you can attack only a certain organism and spare everything else is, of course, the beginning of the most amazing idea of chemotherapy.
Who took that work further?
A very peculiar twist of history occurs, and that is that the war suddenly breaks loose in Europe, World War I, and the wartime chemists arrive at the same chemistry and they say, well, can we build war gases? And in fact, the legacy of these incredible inventive chemists from the late 19th century, which now gets perverted in this ghoulish way, and gives rise to the early war gases. In fact, what's amazing is mustard gas, which is the sort of definitional war gas, really is a chemical byproduct of a variant of the very reaction that produces a chemical dye. And in the war fields, they rain down mustard gas. And there's an incredible description of this when the first gases come down and it decimates the field and leaves these men dead. The war gases burn through the throat, they burn through the eyes, and leave kind of an incredible wake of death behind them. And an amazing thing happens, and that is that a pair of pathologists, American pathologists, notes that mustard gas...
We've moved ahead to World War II here.
That's correct. We've moved ahead to World War II. And these pathologists start thinking to themselves, wait a second, so this gas has nearly killed its victims, but it has specifically attacked the white cells in their bone marrow. So could it be that if you have a malignancy of the white blood cells, could the same or variant of this war gas kill the malignant white cells in your bone marrow and spare the rest of the host? Another scientist, Sidney Farber, discovers his chemotherapy.
Sidney Farber, this is our next significant person here. He goes to the next step. Okay, who's he?
So Sidney Farber was a pathologist. He was called a doctor of the dead. He was a pathologist who sort of lived in the basement of the Children's Hospital in Boston. And he became very interested in childhood leukemia. And Farber began to inject this drug, aminopterin, into young kids in order to see if he could get a remission. And indeed, he found surprising, astonishing remissions in these kids with leukemia.
Now, we've gotten a sense of the amazing journey of the chemistry here, as chemistry was applied to different uses and eventually someone discovered progressively how to do chemotherapy. How did this become a cause that millions of Americans would contribute to or think of as a war on cancer?
So we're now sitting in the 1950s when cancer is a whispered about disease. There's a very famous episode in which this woman, Fanny Rosenau, a very important activist, a breast cancer survivor, she calls up the New York Times and she says, you know, I'm a breast cancer survivor. I'd like to place an advertisement in the New York Times to create a support group around breast cancer. And there's a long pause on the phone. And then finally, bizarrely, the society editor gets on the phone. And the society editor says, well, Ms. Rose, now, you know, the New York Times cannot print the word breast and cancer in its pages. So what if we said that this was a support group of women with chest diseases?
Ugh. She couldn't even pay them to do this,
exactly.
You're saying. She wanted an ad.
Exactly.
And what did she say?
Well, she hung up. She said, I, this is a world in which I can't talk about cancer.
Well, who changed that?
This magnetic personality, Mary Lasker. Mary Lasker was an entrepreneur. She was a socialite. She was a kind of a legendary networker. She became interested in saying, well, you know, if these diseases don't have political support, we'll never conquer them. And she made really cancer her special cause. And she collaborated with Sidney Farber. She found Sidney Farber an ideal ally, a person who could give her project the scientific legitimacy that it needed. And together, Mary Lasker and Sidney Farber were able to persuade Nixon to launch the so-called war on cancer.
President Nixon.
President Nixon, that's right.
So we're into the 60s and 70s now.
That's right.
I want to leap ahead to your own career as a doctor dealing with cancer patients in the last several years. Mm-hmm. Is the world we live in today, in terms of cancer, different than the world was 20 or 30 or 40 years ago?
Absolutely. First of all, it's biologically different because we understand cancer in a very fundamentally different way. I think we know now that cancer is an extremely complex disease, perhaps among the most complex diseases that we face, and it has multiple faces. And there's very little in the field that calls for a universal cure for cancer in the sense that one might have imagined in the 1960s and 1970s. So it's biologically, it's a completely different world. We understand the cancer cell in a much deeper way than we did 20, 30 years ago. And of course, politically, it's changed. We now have poured in an enormous amount of resources into cancer. The National Cancer Institute budget runs about $5 billion a year. That's a large amount of money, but let's not be grandiose about the amount of money we're actually spending on a problem that is attacking us at the most fundamental level of the human species.
Are we getting anything for the money?
Absolutely, we're getting things for the money. I think you would have to be a nihilist to say that we are not making progress on cancer, just like you'd have to be hubristically optimistic to say that we have conquered cancer.
Siddhartha Mukherjee is the author of The Emperor of All Maladies, a biography of cancer. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. Last week, we told you about an ambitious plan called the Simultanea Project. This week, the results. If you heard artist Erin Cooney explain her concept, you'll remember that it was to create a coordinated one-minute snapshot of the world on video.
Well, on Saturday, several hundred participants shot footage at precisely the same moment. Erin Cooney returns now to tell us how it all went. And I want you to remind us first why you encouraged people to do this.
I encourage people to do it basically because I want to see 1 minute played back from as many points of view as I can. It's kind of an attempt to have an out-of-body experience, if you will.
And how many videos did you get?
I've received more than 300 so far.
And you have an audio clip made from all of this footage. What are we about to hear?
You're about to hear audio from 18 different locations from around the world, ranging from Alaska, Thailand, London, Kentucky, New York, Slovenia, Montana, and Arizona, and a couple more.
Okay, let's roll it.
9:00.
We've started. We are in Denali National Park, Alaska.
We're just going to put it together and make it a project.
State in the United States.
Yeah!
Yeah!
Wow. That was terrific. How many places was that from?
That was from a total of 18 places. We were hearing crickets from Thailand. We were even hearing the view from backstage on a Slovenian television show, believe it or not.
I knew that's where that was. No, I'm only kidding.
Of course. Wind chimes in Kentucky. We were hearing a woman in Alaska telling us that it was still nighttime in Alaska. I want people to understand that what they're hearing really was happening in time, just as you hear it. What you hear at Senkent 20 is what was actually taking place at Senkent 20 during the one-minute moment from all over the world.
In all those different places around
the
world.
That's right.
When will the video version be ready, and where can people see it?
Well, I've got a lot of work cut out for me now. It's going to take me many months to produce this. I'm thinking April, spring 2011, and people will be able to see it on my website at simultaneaproject.com as well as streamingmuseum.org. And it's going to play with Streaming Museum, an organization in New York, who have partners around the world, and they have screens in public places and plazas in different cities throughout the world. And it will be shown there as well as in Los Angeles.
Is there anything you've seen or heard in all of these videos that has really surprised you about what was going on at that one particular minute on Earth last Saturday?
You know, I have to say I was thinking I was going to get some really surprising, shocking videos. I haven't received one of those yet, and that's probably a good thing. No, it's really what I asked for. It's a slice of life. You know, I'm seeing people in cars and on their bikes, on motorcycles. I've got a guy who's filmed his point of view while he's on a plane cross country. The thing that is amazing for me during this editing process is to sit down and go through all these submissions, which I still haven't gone through all of them. There's so many. But to see all of these things happening during this 1 minute, it's magical, and I cannot wait to have people be able to see that too.
Well, Erin Cooney, thank you very much for talking with us once again about your Simultanea project.
Robert, thank you so much for having me on.
In another less enjoyable bit of simultaneity, right now someone in Paris and someone in New York are likely reaching the same horrifying conclusion. They have bedbugs. New York has been in the throes of a nasty infestation, and Paris may well be next, according to recent news reports. Well, author Jake Halpern lives in New York and recounts his close encounter of the parasitic kind.
A few weeks ago, my wife wakes me up early in the morning, her face stricken with panic, and announces, "We have bedbugs." "What?" She then shows me the proof, 3 little bites on her back. Moments later, however, she's pulling off the sheets of the bed, peering into the crevices of the mattress, searching for any signs of life. In a way, bedbugs are like sexually transmitted diseases. Nasty, contagious, and embarrassing. For my wife, a Polish immigrant who treats dusting under the couch as a moral obligation, it's even worse than this. The mere presence of bedbugs suggests that she keeps an unclean house. Anyway, we wash everything in the house. But that's not good enough. So we end up paying $400 for a highly trained dog, a Jack Russell Terrier named Bugsy, to pay us a visit. Bugsy is a graduate of the J&K Canine Academy in High Springs, Florida, the Harvard of the canine world, a place where dogs are trained to sniff out bedbugs. So as we wait for Bugsy to arrive, the whole family, me, my wife, our 2 toddlers, maintain a strict policy of silence. Tell absolutely no one, I warn my 3-year-old son. At this point, I'm in a panic too. What about your mother? My wife asks. Do we tell her about the situation? I consider the facts. My mom adores me, but I'm not sure how she would handle the prospect of an infestation. Mum's the word, I tell my wife. So, a few days later, Bugsy shows up at the house with his handler, a guy named Jake Schechter. Jake practically bolts in my front door as if not wanting to be seen. I just did a penthouse on the Upper East Side of New York, a real fancy place. They had 4 cleaning ladies, 2 nannies, and a cook. Of course, I had to sneak Bugsy into the building in a bag so their neighbors wouldn't suspect anything. When inspecting offices, for example, he and Bugsy do their work in the middle of the night. And if they find bugs, the removal process also happens in the middle of the night. This way, the employees never know. In the end, Bugsy didn't find a thing at our house. "You don't have bed bugs," Jake told me. Whew. I felt a surge of relief. And yet, the paranoia lingered. I asked Jake, was it possible that he or Bugsy might have inadvertently brought bedbugs into my house? "Don't worry about it, buddy," he told me knowingly. "I understand. I got a wife, too." For a moment, Bugsy, who was now standing in our foyer, fidgeted. I tensed. Then he fixed me with a look the kind of look that only a dog who charges $400 an hour can give you, which seemed to say, "Chill out, my man. The situation is under control."
Jake Halpern teaches at Yale University. He has a new book out called World's End.
This is NPR News.
In mid-October, Bank of America's stock price took a dive. The markets were spooked by a letter sent to Bank of America on behalf of major investors in mortgage-backed securities. They were demanding that Bank of America buy back billions of dollars in bad loans. But as NPR's Tamara Keith reports, these investors and others face a lot of obstacles.
If you were to imagine an investor in mortgage-backed securities, it would probably be someone like Bill Fry. He owns Greenwich Financial Services and has millions of dollars worth of sour securities on his books. But he says it's entirely possible that you own these toxic investments, too. And when they lose value?
Those are not hurting billionaires sitting in Greenwich, Connecticut or Palm Beach. There's just not enough of those people around. It's hurting American pension funds. It's hurting, you know, your sixth grade school teacher who's sitting in Daytona Beach is having the security behind her pension eaten away.
During the boom years, banks gave out hundreds of billions of dollars worth of home loans, packaged them into securities, and sold them to investors in the form of bonds. Pension funds, mutual funds, and life insurance companies bought them because they promised good returns and relatively low risk. Of course, it hasn't exactly worked out that way. Investors complain that the mortgages put into the securities weren't as good as promised, and that the banks aren't doing a good job of dealing with troubled loans. Fry's 81-year-old mother is a retired schoolteacher.
As I explained this to her, her response was, "We've spent a lot of money on your education, now what are you going to do about it?"
What he's done is launch a campaign to protect investors' interests. He also stands to make a lot of money if he succeeds. Fry wants some of the nation's largest banks to buy back the bad loans. Many of the contracts that created the securities say that if the banks don't hold up their end of the deal, the investors can force them to take the loans back. 3 years ago, Fry thought it would be easy to get other investors to sign on. It hasn't been.
I was greeted as an insane person.
Fry now claims to have won over more than 150 investors. That should allow him to clear the first hurdle, getting legal standing to even start the process. But there are a lot of other obstacles. Before they can file suit, investors have to provide evidence that the bank has breached the contract. Attorney David Grace, who has worked with Fry, says there's a catch-22.
You can't get access to the loan files unless you can prove that there's a problem with the loans, and you can't prove that there's a problem with the loans until you've had access to the loan files.
Grace thinks they've found workarounds for these problems, but there are others. Getting investors to agree on strategy is a challenge, since they often have conflicting interests. And get this, most investors don't even want their names made public. Scott Simon, who oversees mortgage investments at PIMCO, a firm reportedly going after Bank of America, says getting groups of investors together is very hard.
The fact that it's taken as long as it has for really any noise to occur, in spite of people being very upset and trying to do what was in fiduciary best interests of their clients, tells you that's a problem.
And once investors actually do file a suit, the banks have made it very clear they aren't planning to roll over. Bank of America spokesman Jerry Dabrowski hits the same themes as other major banks.
It would be irresponsible on our part to settle the claims without doing a loan-by-loan analysis. You know, if there's a valid claim, we'll act responsibly and repurchase the loan. But if there isn't, we will contest it and we will defend our interests.
Going through these claims loan by loan will be time-consuming. And for investors, the legal fees will add up fast without any guarantee of success. Christopher Whalen at Institutional Risk Analytics says if the investors win, it could push the banks towards insolvency. The numbers are that big.
If they have the wherewithal to sue and to see their way through a miserable, grinding litigation, I think they have a good chance of winning.
But it's a gigantic if, one the banks appear to be betting won't happen, at least not on a large enough scale to do real damage. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.